Hi, I'm Kumi Taguchi and I host a TV show in Australia called Insight, which is unlike any other.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Every week in the same room, we have dozens of guests telling their stories about one shared issue.
There definitely was three people in my marriage.
I started an affair with this man.
From sex and relationships to health, wealth and grief.
Dad, there's been a shooting at the elementary school.
And there's always a guest whose story stays with me.
I actually had guilt for not killing someone.
And I'm left feeling there's so much more I want to ask them. I often wonder, where are they now? So that's what I do here. I go back and I dig a little deeper. This is Insightful. In this episode, I'm meeting up with Angie Jordan. I've thought a lot about her over the last few years. She was on an episode of Insight called Intimate Terrorism. Gently spoken, you could imagine chatting to her at a supermarket. She was just so friendly and so kind. Angie shared how she survived a 40-year marriage to a man who made her feel fearful every single day.
He used to say, "Remember, I can replace you just like that."
It was a tough show, and we opened it with Angie reading her own eulogy. Yes, you heard that right. Angie told us that after her husband's death, she was going through his paperwork and she found the eulogy which he had written.
"Thank you all for attending this very, very sad occasion. I have no idea why Angela did this. She had a loving forever home here with me, surrounded by all of her treasures and her animals. However, Angela made her choice and we must respect that."
I was meant to meet up with Angie in Brisbane, but just as my producer and I were about to board the plane, we turned back around because Angie was flooded into her property. We had planned to go to a nursery and pick up some plants. She loves growing her own veggies. But instead, we're catching up remotely. Angie, it's so great to see you again.
It's lovely to see you again, Kumi, after what, 2 years?
How long were you flooded in for?
It was really only 24 hours. The creeks go down very quickly. The Lockyer Valley is well known for flooding. But if I had left that morning, I would have been sleeping in my truck that night.
When we chatted from the airport, you mentioned, Angie, that you have loads of supplies, like food and stuff for things like this. Have you always been that prepared?
I think that probably has more to do with how I had to live for those 40 years. Everything had to be so organised. And if something wasn't organised, I would pay the price for it. I suppose also because I live by myself, if I'm going to be stuck in for 3 or 4 days or however long, I want some nice food to eat.
Angie, what is life like for you these days?
I often sit and muse with a cup of coffee in the morning when I am just sitting in what I call the present moment, not thinking about the future, not thinking about the past, but just sitting in the present. And I am lucky I've got a lovely property and there's always lots of birds and wildlife around. And I tend to always sit with my morning coffee and I'm out with the dogs and I am just incredibly grateful for the life that I have now, the life that I have made for myself. It is a life that I didn't even know existed.
Did it take a while to sort of realise this is my life and it will be like this for as long as I want it to be?
It does take a long time. Even now, I can have moments. Obviously, anybody that knows my story, you know, I am left with depression and I still suffer from hypervigilance. And I can be really happy and enjoying everything, but sometimes there will just be something that just comes along like that and I think, God, this could all be taken from me. Because depending on how long you've been in a domestic violence relationship, there are still times when I can actually find myself upset thinking that this could be taken from me. I mean, there is nobody that's going to take it, but it's what you live with, you know, the after effects.
You prefer to call
him your abuser, not your husband. What was he like when you met him, Angie? How old were you? How old was he?
I was 18. He was 14 years older than I was. He fitted the absolute profile. He has been profiled as a psychopath and a predator. And he fitted the bill to a T. Everything that you read about them, they're just charismatic. Everything listed about them. He ticked every single box. But I was a young 18-year-old girl. And this man just swept me off my feet. He was just everything. But of course, the everything you pay for.
Did you fall in love with him?
Now, that is a question that I had to answer to myself in a psychology session. And this was a really hard one to come to terms with, that I didn't love him. Never did. Because how can you love a monster? What I fell in love with never existed. That was just the mirror. So no, I didn't love him. Who could love someone that kept a picture of Ted Bundy on their phone?
The daily abuse you experienced, Angie, began very early in your marriage. How early did it start?
There was abuse before we actually got married, but had the big apology and, you know, it'll never happen again. And it was from what his ex-wife had put him through. That's why he was overreacting. Of course, that was all lies. But once we got married, it was game over for me, game on for him. He was just intending to live literally a single life with a wife sat at home. The first abuse was when he had come home extremely late and I had cooked a meal which ended up being thrown up the wall. I was trying to hold him accountable and I got dragged across the room, pushed to the floor, and he burnt the back of my neck with the cigarette that he was smoking.
When that was happening, Angie, could you even fathom what was happening to you?
No. My parents, still married, did they argue? Yes, everybody argues. I had never in my life ever seen this level of violence. I'd never seen it, and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know what to do with what had happened that night. But it was after that that I had the silent treatment, and these were the words that I ended up hearing probably thousands of times over the years. He just turned to me and said, "It gives me no pleasure doing these things. I'm just trying to make you a better person." And that is what was drilled into me. So every time there was an attack, however it was, that is what I was told.
I'm conscious, Angie, of just sharing this over and over and with us and with other people. Is it okay for you to be talking about this? Like, do you find it difficult to keep going over these memories?
It's one of those things, when you're living in it, it's like, that's all I ever knew. I only ever knew the abuse. I didn't know of a world outside of how I was living, being controlled and everything else that goes with it. But one thing that you do within those relationships is you take all of your emotions and you bury them down. You don't cry, you don't laugh too much, you don't do anything. So now, when I'm asked to talk about it, I sit here as Angie. But the girl and the woman that went through it, Angela, I don't know how she did it. I don't know how she got up every day and survived for those 40 years. So when I'm asked to talk about it, I do get emotional. Because now I look across at her and I think, how the hell did you do it? How did you do it? I don't know how she did it. I don't know how she did it. So I will always get emotional talking about it. And because I look at it from a different perspective now, I look at her and I don't know how she did it.
Do you ever talk to her, talk to that Angela, or have conversations with her?
Yes. Because I have to nurture her and I have to tell her it's not her fault and that she deserved better than what she had. So yes, I do.
Oh, it's so hard to even listen to, Angie.
What I have found out about myself is that I am an incredibly emotional person. You know, I will laugh at the drop of a hat and I will cry at anything because when I talk about it now, and I will always talk about it as long as people want to hear my story, because I've always said, you know, if talking about it saves that one woman, then I can say that's why I had to live those 40 years. That was my purpose in life. That's the only way I can go forward. This was my purpose.
Angie, your abuser went to extremes to keep an eye on you at all times. What were some of the things he did?
He was logged into all my accounts. He was on my Facebook. He was on my Messenger. So if anybody messaged me, he knew about it. I can remember one instance, the pool maintenance man had messaged me asking if he could come around the next morning. My abuser said to me, "You block and delete him. You don't want that man messaging you. I know what he's up to." In the early days, he had somebody following me all the time. He employed someone to follow me. There was a webcam set up in the house so he could watch me going up and down the stairs. If anybody, we used to have horses, if the farrier came to the property, he would sit on the top balcony with his binoculars watching. And then when I used to come back up to the house after the farrier had finished, he would always say the same thing to me. "Oh, did you have sex with the farrier?" And I'm like, "No."
What was it like living basically in constant fear, being monitored, being accused? How did you cope?
I don't know how she did it, because you have to get everything so right. So a lot of the health problems that I suffered for years, have gone now. I don't have the migraines anymore. I don't have neck problems, I don't have back problems because I was constantly hunched up, and I don't have all my stomach issues are sorted out because you are running all the time in flight, fight or freeze mode.
Did you ever feel like you could talk to family or friends about his behaviour?
No, because another saying that would be repeated to me is, "You're a liar. Everything that comes out of your mouth is lies and no one will believe you." Not quite put as eloquently as that, but we are on a podcast. So, no, I didn't think anybody would believe me. And everybody thought he was a great guy. Everybody thought he was just wonderful. I mean, we lived this most amazing life. But over time, things have been said. I mean, my own parents have said, "We always felt that there was something wrong, but we couldn't put our finger on it and you never said anything." And there was me thinking everybody thought he was great, but after his death, when I was starting to speak to somebody, there wasn't many people that had a very good word for him. But because he always told me that I was a liar and nobody would believe me, you begin to believe it in the end. You believe the lies.
When did you realise that what you were living with wasn't normal?
To be honest, I only really realised when I first started therapy, about 3 years ago. Even after he'd been removed from the house that we lived in, even when I'd left him, even after when he had taken his own life, I really only truly start to see it when I started therapy.
Prior to that, you went to an information session where someone told you that what you were experiencing was domestic violence. Had you ever considered that that was you?
No. I thought how I lived was normal, because that had become my normal. And even if I had said anything to my abuser, he would just shout at me, "How would you know? You've never been married before. This is what married life is like." What you have to imagine is it was a hostage situation. Now, imagine that you've been kept hostage for 40 years and suddenly somebody throws the doors open and they go, "There you go. Off you go. You can do anything you want now. You can be anything you want." You are like a rabbit in the headlights. How do you know what you want? I didn't know what I want. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know how I wanted to dress. I didn't know, because I only lived within my abuser's bubble. And now that bubble had gone. And I was stood there, like emotionally naked. How do I know what I want to do? I have had this person for 40 years tell me everything I must do. How to have your hair done, what clothes I can wear, who I speak to, no TV, not listening to your music, not allowed to sit and read a book. And if you do, he will come and just keep, you know, finding you things to do. The sleep deprivation at night, the keeping you working round the clock, not having one moment to sit and rest. And now you can do whatever you like. You try to imagine how you deal with that, because you can't. I am telling you, at that point, when you're released, it is the most terrifying moment, because I didn't know who I was. Who was I? I didn't know who I was. I had no idea.
Angie, can you tell me about the day you decided to leave your marriage?
What I would have to ask, was that the first or the second time? Because I did go back once. I was re-groomed back into it.
Which is quite common.
The average is at least 7 times. I got re-groomed once. So I will talk about that time, because that is when I finally did leave him. Went back. Of course, it was all wonderful, because it always is when you go back to the old narcissist. It's just, you know, flowers, and it's just going to be terrific. But it wasn't very long before I said that I was going to start doing yoga classes, and I was told, no, you can't do yoga classes. I will get you a private instructor into the house to do yoga lessons with you. And at that point, I thought, nothing's changed. This is just the same old shit. And I remember getting really angry with myself, saying, how could you think he would have changed? But the point when I had said to myself, enough, was the morning I woke up and he was stood over the top of me and he said to me, do you know what I did when you were asleep? I said, no. And I can remember feeling frightened by those words. And he said to me, when you were sleeping, I put my fingers on your carotid artery. And if I'd left them there for, I think he said 15 or 20 seconds, he said, you would have died and you wouldn't have even known about it. You wouldn't have even known. And I remember just getting out of that bed. I have to leave. I have to leave. And then the morning I left, I told him I was leaving. And he became so enraged. And he was banging his fist on the table. And that is when he said to me that he would find me. He would have my door kicked in. He would have me gang raped or murdered.
At that point when he's banging his fist on the table, Angie, did you think you would be able to get out of the house?
I'd made peace, I think, with the fact that I knew that I would end up dying. But I used to think it'll be over. I'll have peace. It'll stop.
Were there moments where you're thinking, how did my life get to this?
You do. Because you look back and you're seeing something that never existed. The show, the life that you put on for people to see, that's all it was. It was a show. It never existed. It's like picking up a big rock. You have to throw it at that mirror and it has to shatter, because that's all your life was. It didn't exist. It was just a pretense. And that's hard, because you have given all of this time to someone who never loved you, never loved their family, destroyed everything around them. And you have to live with that.
Your abuser died by suicide. Was there a level of relief?
He killed himself, because he always, that was one of the many things he held over me. He always threatened if I left him, he would take his own life. So when I started to call him out on this behaviour, when he was refusing to give me a divorce or a settlement, he was refusing to give me anything, and I was living with nothing. I said to him, you will stand in court and you will be held accountable for what you have done to me. And even then, just telling me that I was a liar, and, you know, nobody's going to believe you. I just said to him, I remember I was walking past him and he tried to grab me, so I just knocked him, you know, sort of flicked him away with my hand. And he said to me, you know, I know you still have love in your heart for me. And I said, you have no idea how much I hate you. You couldn't even begin to understand how disgusted I am. And I think it was at that point that it's what is called the classic narcissist collapse. He knew he was going to be held accountable for what he'd done to me. There was no way, he knew that there was no way of re-grooming me back in. And now he was going to do what he always said, that if I left him, he would kill himself. And he did. He took his own life and he did it so that I found him.
When was it where you started feeling like there was hope for your life and a future that you could imagine and an Angie that you could nurture and discover?
That was the day that I put the keys into the front door of my home. This is going to make me cry, always does. As I walked up to the door and I put the key in, I remember opening the door and just standing there and just taking that moment, because as I walked over that threshold, I truly was walking out of my past and into my future.
When we were meant to come up and see you a couple of weeks ago, we were going to go to a nursery and buy some plants. What do you love about plants? What do you love about gardening?
I love growing all my own vegetables. It's probably going back to the abuse, because when you're with a narcissist, everything has to be now, today. No, I don't want to wait for anything. Everything has to be instant. And I think with gardening, for me, I started doing this obviously when I first moved into my home, because I struggled with sitting. I still struggle sometimes, that I feel like you can't sit. No, come on, get up, do something. I found being out on the property was the one thing that I could do that I could actually switch off of. And I think it's the thing of, you know, standing there, sowing your seedlings, putting them in the ground and watching them grow, feeding your body, nurturing your body, and knowing that you have taken this from a seed to a vegetable or a fruit, and you've done it all. And it didn't have to happen quickly, which is how you would be in an abusive relationship. And there is something incredibly special about that. There is something incredibly special about going out at the end of the day with a little basket and picking some tomatoes and some lettuce leaves and a cucumber and taking it into the kitchen and being present in that moment, preparing something for yourself, nurturing yourself, looking after yourself, all the things that you never did in that abusive relationship.
For anyone who would be stepping out of an abusive relationship, trying to sort of open that door, what advice would you give them, Angie?
For all women or men, whoever is getting out of an abusive relationship, you have to step out of being a victim. And you have to get your foot on the first run of the ladder to being a survivor. You have to find help. You have to start doing work on yourself. Because if you don't, you are going to remain a victim. You're going to remain a victim for your own abuser to walk back in and re-groom you. And also you possibly are going to remain a victim to go into another unhealthy relationship. So I would implore anybody that is coming out of an abusive relationship to seek some form of help. Seriously, it is the only way. You have got to step off of being a victim and you've got to step on to being a survivor.
Angie, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you again. I cannot think of a week, honestly, that's gone by since I first met you where I haven't thought about you. So thank you so much for making the time.
You are more than welcome, Kumi. I just, to be in somebody's mind every week, wow, that's quite powerful, isn't it? It's been lovely to catch up, and thank you very much for inviting me to be on your podcast.
You've been listening to Insightful, an 8-part series from SBS, recorded in Sydney, Australia, on the land of the Gadigal people. Insightful is produced by Felicity Davey, Cassandra Allen and Kate Harassi, and edited by Maddox Foster. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay tuned for more. Until next time, I'm Kumi Taguchi. Thanks so much for your company.